More plain tales from the Raj. A panorama of British India, recorded in the voices of those who lived in it. Programme 5, Milligan Chota Sahib.
Terence Allen Milligan, better known as Spike Milligan, is the son of Bombardier Leo Milligan, Royal Artillery, and grandson of Trumpet Major Alfred Henry Kettleband, whose trumpet is one of his most treasured possessions. In this program, he tells the story of his childhood in India.
The first visions I remember of India was, of course, this bright sunlight, very bright sunlight. England is a dull climate. It was a dirty climate. The pollution in the air was rife. It was the great age of coal fires. When the troops suddenly went to India, here was a white, hot, golden sunlight which showed up the smallest speck. The speck that got away on parade at Aldershot was like a ink stain on the parade ground at Pune. So there we had the sudden revelation of light. India was possibly the greatest experience of my life. I grew up in bright sunshine. I liked bright things. I grew up with tremendous space. I grew up with animals. I grew up with excitement. I grew up believing that these people, the white people, were superior, most superior to anybody else. Being born in India gave me a different relationship to the Indian people than troops brought from England. I was born to believe that we were the top people, because as I grew up there was an ayah and a bearer who used to clean my shoes and pipe clay them. There was an ayah who used to give my dinner. There was a tumbi who used to take me for walks. All in all, I had a very good, strong social relationship with them, but I always acted like I was the master, because as I was brought up, I used to scream and yell if they didn't do this and that and all that. I spoiled little brat. But at the same time, I had a closer tie with them. I used to speak their language for a start. I used to go in the godown and eat their food with them. I used to play with the chokers, Hare Krishna, Thambi, Minimar, and Manjulabai. I used to play around on the Maya dance with them all the time. They always accepted me as a leader, because that they'd been born to it too, these little kids like this. But I had a very close relationship, inasmuch that I realized later on in life that they were very nice people and that I wasn't the leader at all. I was just lucky that that was a particular period in time which put me in that position.
Chokras, by the way, are little boys. And a maidan is an open space. Parade ground, hockey field, park, and anything else you like.
My father, like most Irishmen born in the 1900s, came from a very poor family. And at that time, it seemed almost two ways were out for you. One was to become a navvy, or one was to become a soldier. And of course, I think that the Irish, being a romantic race, most of them opted to become soldiers. In this case, my father did not want to become a soldier.
I once had a comrade named Arthur McBride. As he and I rambled down by the seaside, we were looking for pleasure than what may be tied, and the weather was pleasant and charming. Well, as he and I rambled down by the sea strand, we met Sergeant Napier and Corporal O'Han, and a little wee drummer named Patrick McDan. They were going to the fair in the morning. Oh, now, said the sergeant, if you will enlist, 5 guineas in gold
stick in your fist. And besides a 5 shilling, just to kick off the dust and to drink the king's health in the morning. Oh no, said McBride, if we take an advance, all right, bloody slender will be our poor chance. For the king wouldn't scruple for to send us to France and get us all shot in the morning.
But the family, his father, who was also in the artillery, decided that the best thing for the boy was to go into the army. So my father forcibly went into the army at the age of 14 and became, I suppose, a rough rider. They called it the Woolwich Academy. Well then, he went from there to Ireland, and from Ireland the regiment was posted to India.
Now when we got the rout and for India we set out, the girls were crying round us to the docks, boys off. So we gave 3 hearty cheers for the pretty little dears, in the hopes they've each one got another soldier. Bang upon the big drum, clash upon.
Apropos of the sea trip from England, they went aboard at the Albert Docks, that's right. And he said that conditions on board were atrocious. Bay of Biscay, they had something like a force 8 gale, which is hell in the bay. And he said the whole ship literally became, to quote his words, a vomit bucket. Of course, they put them ashore at Gibraltar. And of course, this was a complete and wonderful new world to many of these soldiers, one of whom apparently had never seen the sea. And one evening, apparently, when the ship was going past the Narrows at Gibraltar, this chap was standing at the side, and my father thought it was rather strange that he should be hanging over the side when the sea was calm at last. And he said, "Are you still seasick?" And the bloke said, "No, no." He said, "What are you hanging over the side?" He said, "Well, I was trying to get a closer look at the sea." He said, "No, I've never seen it before." Then he gave a long look at it and said to my father, "Is that all it does?"
"You don't have to buy anything very cheap, sir. Just second bridge, come along with me, sir."
Anyhow, they landed, by the way, at Bombay, and the transport then was all horse-drawn. Shit and treacle was the common name, but it was the supply and transport. And these GS wagons, with, I think, two of these heavy bay horses, I think they were, they put all their kit bags on that, and they marched to the railway station, and they took a train, that's right, from there, from Bombay, over the Ghats, I think it was, to Pune, where they detrained, and they went to Gorpuri Barracks, Pune, which was adjacent to the Pune racecourse. My mother was born of a marriage between Margaret Burnside, the daughter of a wheelwright in the Woolwich Arsenal, and Alfred Henry Kettleband, the son of John Henry Kettleband, who had been in India in about 1850. My mother was the eldest child. My father met her when she was singing in the choir at St. Patrick's Cathedral, Pune. All troops used to attend church parades then, merely for the reason of being as close as they possibly could to the pretty daughters of these officers and NCOs of the time. And that is exactly how it worked out. My father started talking to my mother, and they eventually became engaged and got married. I was born in Ahmednagar at 3 p.m. of a wooden military hospital on the 16th of April 1918, and my father was at the time at a firing practice near Uti Command. And he received a long envelope from a mad major, Major Riddick, who'd stamped the envelope, "War 1914-18, urgent, a secret, highly confidential, not to be opened," and in the case of in all this, and I still had that, saying, "From one mad Irishman to the second mad Irishman, son born this morning, so far has refused to walk, but we'll soon have him on his feet." Signed the Mad Major, Major Riddick, who had apparently been along at the delivery. That was my coming into the world.
Ari cuckoo, jari cuckoo, jungle pucker bear, Amara baba hana manta damri kato ser, Namrika to sera, Namrika to sera, Namrika to sera, Namrika to sera.
We used to fire a gun at sunup from Gorpri Barracks, then I'd hear. Then the morning gun would go, this boom, used to echo all around the quiet. And I know what used to startle was the crows would get startled. You'd hear, boom, wah, 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 wah. That was the morning gun. The house we had a circular tiled roof. At the front of the house, there was corrugated iron, which lent out to stop rain beating in through the trellis work, which was half of the front of the house, this wooden trellis. And up to about waist high, there was a wall. I used to sleep against this trellis and look out at night and see the stars as a boy. And, of course, at night when the monsoons came, this thunderous rain would pour on this roof. And I can still hear that magic sound, like drumming of millions of muffled hooves. It's a wonderful sound. And I used to fall asleep many a night to the sound of this violent rain and this green, white, purple lightning. It used to be sheet lightning in India, not the fork lightning, just great flashes across the whole sky like this. Queen Victoria had died long before I'd been born. And yet, in the dining room of our house in Clymer Road, there was a picture of Queen Victoria on the wall, and next to it was a picture, not of Edward VII, but King George V. And at Christmas times, he used to drink a toast to my granddad, and he'd say, first of all, to the Queen, God bless her. And then he would drink to the King. And apparently, this double toast went on for quite a period, and it was almost as if the real, last real Empress of India was Queen Victoria, and not King George V, despite the fact that he had a durbar. But I remember this going through many, many houses in my childhood and seeing Queen Victoria's picture on the wall. It seems as if she was the very lifeblood. It was better to hold allegiance to a woman in an almost femaleless society. And I think this had a distant sort of sex bond with the isolated soldiers, that they were fighting for a queen and not a man.
And when we say we've always won, and when they ask us how it's done, we'll proudly point to everyone of England's soldiers of the Queen.
I was brought up with these soldiers all around me. Whenever I broke any of my toys, I would go to the farrier of the regiment. And I broke my little steam engine once, and I went across to Bombardier Eggert. I remember his name, and he mended my train. I remember the exact job he did. The axle had gone, and he took the axle out, heated it in this huge fire where he used to shoe the horses, and made it red hot, pushed it through the two wheels, and then flanged the edge. And I often used to go there as a boy just to watch this wonderful experience of horses being shoed. And I went to school in a tent. This was a military school as well. And one of the first exciting moments of my life was that in Hyderabad Sindh, which is on the edge of a desert, the sandstorms would blow up, and we all had to run outside and sit on a tent peg and a rope to hold the tent down. I don't think I learnt much at all in that school. I remember then going into Hyderabad itself, which is a Mohammedan town, very dirty, and the drains were open on each side of the street, row after row of very small shops, a muddy sort of buildings. And we used to go to the Hyderabad Sindh Command Bioscope Theatre, which was made of wood and had partitions for where soldiers would sit, and officers, and the wogs, as they were called then, the bleeding wogs. And I remember watching a very early version of Elmo Lincoln, the first silent Tarzan of the screen, appearing at this bioscope. And I, to this day, as baffled as to why the Indians always cheered whenever Elmo Lincoln appeared on the screen. There's a great burst of cheering from the
from the wogs, you see. But dead silence from the ranks, or jeers, you see. The soldiers, of course, they turned out, they used to go down to the bazaars in the evening. They'd go to the pictures, pick up Indian prostitutes who used to line the more dubious streets in the brothel areas. They would get drunk, but they seemed to be disciplined enough to get back to the cantonments without causing any hell on the way. Of course, there were the usual quota of Indian tonga wallahs being walloped and thudded and not being paid and being thrown out and the tonga driven at high speed towards the cantonment. But of course, all the penalties were very stiff in those days. And it wasn't long before when my grandfather used to tell me that he used to give men lashed to the gun wheels until noonday. From reveille till noonday, they were lashed to a gun wheel in the sun with only their shorts.
I had the same attitude towards officers coming from an ordinary ranker's family as the Indians had for the whites. I really thought that the officer was God. I remember that they had very loud voices and very proper, and I really thought that they were the gods. And I never got very close to them without being terrified of my life, because they were very noisy and very red-cheeked and very well turned out and always on horses, so always looked taller than me. And they all do things with tremendous panache. If they really were the elite of the elite, and we were always subjected to this. Officers will rule the earth. A click of a heels. If you heard click of heels, you knew that an officer was somewhere near and somebody was standing to attention. And they used to stand to attention like ramrods. Now, watch my father salute one. I thought his arm was going to drop off with the ferocity of the salute. Even when we were out in the street going to the bazaar and an officer went by in his car or his horse, my father would do this tremendous salute. So I grew up almost saluting it. I grew up with this inferiority complex towards officers. I realize now, in retrospect, that's why they could order men to their death in World War II, and they would do it, because there was no two ways about it. You did what you were told. And they did keep everybody else in their place, and they were very blasé, and they were very snobby, and being Indian Army officers, they were even superior to ordinary British Army officers. The Armistice Day parade on the polo grounds at Pune. That was the most fantastic spectacle I will ever see off the screen. And the colours are as vivid to me at this moment as they were then. There was the entire spectrum of the Indian Lancers, each one of which wore a different coloured turban. There was the scarlet turban, scarlet and khaki and black breeches with the blue and white pennant. There was the Bengal Lancers, who had a multicoloured turban, striped. I think it was blue and white. I might be wrong. It's a long time ago. I remember the officers wore dark blues, and some of the NCOs wore red tops with different coloured pennants. Then there was the regiment that wore the all-black turban with a sort of a band down the side. Yes, yes, Guinness horse, yes, with the yellow uniforms, that's right. And the horses themselves were all carefully graded. There was whites, roans, bays, all different colours. It looked as if somebody had done a decor for what coloured horses would go with what coloured uniforms and turbans. And the noise, the jingle of the harness, and the shouting of the various commands. There was the Dogras, the Rajputs, the Hindis, all the Pathan regiments, the Waziris, the Irregulars. The orders were shouted out by the white officers in all the different languages. It was a marvellous spectacle. And the limbers with the guns, burnished bright, like gold, and all the spices standing along the side, they're holding the horses for the colonels waiting to go on board. Now, the most exciting sound for me was the sound of the irregular Punjabi regiment playing the Dhillon Shana. And they just had these, and they had counter rhythms. I remember that one beat was dum 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 dum. And oh, they're marvelous. Oh, marvelous days. And they used to come in with trail arms like this, and they'd throw the rifle up in the air, like catch it in their left arm, all of this dum 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 dum, and then stamp their foot and fire one round in synchronizing with the drum. They go left, right, left, right, smash, dum 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 dum. It was sensational. This tremendous regiment came bursting into the dust on the heels of an English regiment.
this all contrasted, of course, very much with the... You suddenly hear this...
Then...
The drum would come in. And this was the silver bugles of the Royal Ulster Rifles.
Green forage caps, that's right, black buttons, the cords around the epaulets here like this, coloured cords, black, green, dark green and coloured cords, silver bugles, then brass bugles, and with the drums. Yes, they used to come in, and they used to come in at a belt too. They used to come in like this. Then, of all things, you'd see this regiment, this is the Dogras. The Dogras had a round yellow puggri with almost a flat top, a skull cap. Red jacket with yellow and blue, black trousers, naked legs, and sandals. And they used to come in with the pipes. Highland Laddie. Slow march. Wonderful slow march. Very tall, tall men they were. Then there was the Rajputana Rifles. They came with a full brass band, playing things like South African song, Dolly Gray. You know, some very strange music used to come out. And of course, what the thing was, the other band music was still fading into the distance as this fresh one came on. So there was an endless conveyor belt of different musics and colours, and all the time this dust rising up from the Mayadan and settling. It looked like a dream picture through a cloud of a strange gauze curtain. You know, marvellous.
Well, the officer's wife seemed even further more remote than the officers. They always seemed to look very pale and very beautiful and well gowned and never moving very fast. If they were on horses, lots of them rode side saddle, which intrigued me no end. And they wore a sort of khaki skirts, split skirts. Some more daring ones wore jodhpurs and rode astride, mostly side-saddle. When you saw them at the end of the big dance, if there's a regimental dance, that's the only time that you got the officers and the other ranks all going together. And then you'd see them there, and they always congregated around where the Governor-General was, or the Major, or the Colonel. They'd be always up at a special end of the room, which was sort of cordoned off by the stairs of the senior officers, you know. One or two slightly inebriated soldiers would go up and say, during the excuse me dance, which was the daring time, to go and tap an officer on the shoulder, salute him, and say, "Please, sir, kreidai, halalah," and faint, possibly. But they would dance, you know. I mean, within a few minutes, somebody tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Right, that's all right, rifleman O'Rourke, thank you," and off we go. I remember the band sitting up there, and always amid these potted plants, they used to play a lot of waltzes from Strauss, and Chanson de Nuit, I think it was, by Elgar. By trial and error, and as many of the graveyards of India will show, cleanliness, or bullshit, as the army called it, was not only imperative to look respectable, but also to be as hygienic as possible in India meant you were going to survive that much longer. If you look at the graveyards of India, and my father took a collection of photographs, the mortality rate was unbelievable. My own uncle, Alfie, died at the age of, 5 years old, of diphtheria in a tented hospital where they'd done a tracheotomy, and that was still not good enough. And my mother, a little girl, she was sat by the bed while he screened himself to death, trying to breathe. This mortality was quite ordinary, you know. And the raging fevers were such an important part of my childhood, lying in these beds and my mother pouring cold water. And when we could get any, baraf, that's Hindustani for ice. She'd rubbed me down with that, and I remember these terrible fevers, and I since thought, what were the poor troops like who didn't get somebody standing by the bed rubbing them down with ice? Must have been very, very rough soldiering. Very, very rough soldiering. I remember getting malaria, and I had a very, very high temperature, and a sandstorm blew up, and I was underneath my mosquito net. I was around about 4.5 going on for 5. And I remember the doctor coming in, the medical doctor, and I remember smelling him. He smelt of whiskey, and it was late in the evening, and he'd come from the officer's mess quite obviously, and he was quite drunk. It's all you could do in those days in India, that or watch Elmo Lincoln at the command bioscope. And he came in, and even now I remember him saying, get wet cloths and keep wiping them down with cold water. Do that. Keep my wet cloths and cold water. And I remember my mother sitting up all night by oil lamps, of course, and underneath this net, and I remember having hallucinations. And I suppose these conditions were even vastly improved to what the British India Army must have been in about 1900. Anyhow, my mother nearly had a nervous breakdown because of the dreadful conditions, living in tents, and it was a man's area, really. Anyhow, we were sent back to Pune.
My father was away quite a bit from our home at 5 Plymouth Road, so the man who loomed large in my life was my grandfather, Trumpet Sergeant Major Kettleband. He was the complete Victorian. He was 6 foot, slim. He had a waxed moustache, very, very pointed at the ends. And I remember when I was very, very small, he used to let me twirl them at the ends. And he was very fond of me. He took such a pride in his appearance. I remember that he used to get Thumby, the bearer in our house, to polish the soles of his boots at the front and at the back, and burnish the blakeys with a small piece of black emery paper. And I remember hearing that sound so clearly in my childhood, that sort of tick, tick, tick sound that used to come in. His complete appearance, I remember immaculate khaki drill trousers, creased beyond all belief. You had a feeling that his legs were creased as well inside. And the big evening was the Sunday evenings, because this meant him putting on his best dress, which was a service blues. This was a wonderful uniform. It was dark blue, buttoned high up to the neck, inside of which was worn a white sort of a clerical collar, which just peeped over the top of the collar. Then there was the gold bombs of the Royal Artillery, on each side. The edge of the collar in the front was trimmed with gold. Then they had amazingly bright buttons. They looked like the sun all the way down. He had great scrolls of gold on his sleeve with crossed trumpets, surmounted with the lion, the unicorn, the crown above that on the sleeve. Then his gold stripes on each arm with a gold crown mounted above it. Then there was the epaulets, which had the bomb in as well. They were trimmed with scarlet. The other trimmings with scarlet were down the side of the trousers, which were tight. He wore his riding boots underneath the trousers, and the trouser went over the top and had elastic join underneath, and there was the spurs at the back. He wore his web belt, which was a golden, reddish-brown gold colour. That's right, that was the complete dress. He never wore his sword on Sundays, although he kept it on a rack by his bed. I realise now the reason why he kept his sword there might have been in the event of emergencies, because India was always a place of unrest. He trusted his servants, but I always had the feeling that he thought that anybody who wasn't white was a wog. That seemed to be universal at the time, although he was very kind to the servants. He would berate them in a very loud, fierce voice, shouting things like, Jaldi jao, kam karao, idarao, turakom kaipadun karta hai, which was very frightening to me. It made him very big in my esteem, and these servants used to run like the clappers and do what he told them. I never thought of anything else except the Indians being inferior than me, you know, even though they beat me at everything, at hockey, gilly dandu, at turn tickets. That was a game the Indians used to play
all the betting tickets from the West Indian Turf Club in Pune were about 2 inches long and about half an inch wide, and each one had bright colours. And it was a collector's piece to collect them. And we used to play a game. We used to put two of these tickets face downwards, and you took a third ticket and you threw it down and tried to turn the two tickets underneath over. If you did that, you won them. And the Indians used to beat me hands down. They used to beat me when I used to do fighting kites. I used to use a string called mandia, which was a mixture of gum arabic and ground glass. And you'd let your kitab up into the sky. This kite, and they'd have kite fights. And these Indians used to beat me at that, and then they'd play gilli dando. It's a game you should play a stick which is sharpened at each end, which you hit at one end, it goes up in the air, and then you hit it as far as you can with the stick held in the hand. They'd beat me at that. They'd beat me at hockey, whereas I had a fine hockey stick from Timothy White's stores in Pune. They would win the game with a stick taken out of a tree, sharpened with all the branches cut off. They beat me at football. They beat me at everything. The most black and white observation one could make about the soldiers of the Lion at that time was that they were most certainly disciplined. Whether they liked it or not, I don't know. But the effect of discipline upon them is evident everywhere. I think they were all searching for affection, because, let us face it, they were completely cut off from their families. Not only cut off by being in the regiment, but cut off by being in a different continent. Sex, of course, must have raised its head. I used to go and talk to the soldiers, you know. I used to like to talk to children. They'd ask you about your sister, you know, and things like that. Have you got a pretty sister, they'd say. What's she like? Has she got nice legs? You know, has she got big titties and all that, you know what I mean? And I'd say, I didn't realise what it was all about. I'd say, yes, I think she's got big titties. You know, have you seen her in the bath, they'd say, and things like that. You know, poor men were starved for sex, and even... Oh, I really, I could have made a lot of money just describing my fabulous sister, which I didn't have. So, sex, most certainly... was on, because they all needed it. But I never saw any breakouts. I presume that they used to go down what we used to call the brothel area. In Bombay it was called the cages. In Pune it was called the Nedge. I don't know what it means. They say he's going up the Nedge. I suppose they had women there. I don't know whether it was an accredited brothel. I presume secretly the army would have said, yes, look here, this is the best place to go if you've got to have it away. I think they've done it secretly like that. But there was no mention of it, nor did I hear a whisper of it. And as a child, I had my ears open all the time. I think these men were a different species. It's possible for an era to think, feel, and act entirely different from another one, which is coming up 50 years ahead. I think these men were very controlled because it was a thing to be controlled. They stayed consistent to the period they were living in. But most certainly then they were disciplined, and that was the whole basis of these men. I think if a man hadn't been disciplined then and couldn't take it, he'd have gone mad. Of course, many of them did go mad. And during these long, hot, torrid afternoons where the air was so still, if you ran a sort of razor blade down it, you could part it almost and walk through it. They would lie on their beds, on their charpoys, that is, possibly many of them naked, under a mosquito net to keep the flies off, and the only thing moving was the punkah about them, going backwards and forwards, and I suppose many a man has just sat there and watched the punkah going backwards and forwards because the heat was so intense. There was little else one could do but just watch. I suppose the great thing that you needed discipline for was keeping mental stability, because a new sort of disease came into the language, and that was called Dulali Tap, which was a mental condition, which would be called neuroses today, in which men went mad, went on the rampage, smashed things up, or would stand outside and shout at the major, I want to bloody will shoot you the moment you come out, things like that. They just wanted an out. They wanted to get out of it all, and they didn't know how to do it, other than by making an exhibition of themselves. Shooting occurred, men shooting themselves, mostly
If I remember correctly, they used to put the rifle up to the roof of their mouth and put their finger on the trigger and just blow the top of their head out. Now, there's a story my granddad used to tell about a place up near the Khyber Pass, a fort there, which was on the edge of a great precipice. And the troops used to do a tour of duty up there, and apparently there was a number of suicides. These young chaps would chuck themselves over the precipice into this great chasm. And because of this, they put a special guard on at night to stop these chaps doing it. And one night, apparently, there was an old sweat on there, walking up and down, and the young major came out, and he says, "Oh, who goes there?" He says, "Captain of the guard." "And is he?" "Righto, pass, Captain of the guard, all's well." And he said, "Anything to report?" He said, "Nothing to report, sir." He said, "What are your orders?" He said, "Well," he said, "report any unusual occurrence." So he said, "I see." He said, "Well, what would you call an unusual occurrence?" He said, "Don't really know, really, no." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're here on guard to stop an unusual occurrence. You know what it is?" He said, "No. Oh, stupid, oh, no, I don't. I'm sorry, sir. I don't know what unusual occurrence is." He said, "Look here. Supposing one of the young men just out from England comes here and comes run screaming across the parade ground, raving drunk, and comes in, chucks himself over the edge of the precipice down to the chasm below." He said, "Yes." "So, wouldn't you call that an unusual occurrence?" He said, no, at all." "So what would you call an unusual occurrence?" "Well, if he got up and come back again." The Indian army horse was as much a soldier as the man who rode him. When you heard Grabat, the horses would be out on the Maidan grazing, and you'd hear the stable sounded, and my God, these horses would kick up their heels, and as one man all raced back to the stables, and each one to his own little divisions as you went into it, each one into his own one, and all at the same time. It was incredible. The first thing they would do, I think, would be to give them a complete... They had these two-handed brushes, I remember, and I remember that the hairs on them were yellow, very bright yellow hairs, like big long bristles. They were about 3 inches long, and they would go over these horses, and I remember when you do this to a horse, his skin pulls back each time like this. As you go along, the skin pulls back, I remember, so and this wonderful aroma of the horse which comes out of the screaming. Anyhow, they'd love it, the horses. You'd stand dead still, you know, that sort of noise, and their head going left and right now and then, untethered they used to be, and they'd go very carefully over the snow all the way like this, all the way down, right down to the ground. Then there was a smaller set of brushes which I remember were black. Now, this apparently was to get the hair much closer together. And then the final one, they used to rub their hands together, the sizes like this, and just rub their hands onto the coat. I remember the noise used to make, dup, 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 all over the top like this. Then they used to clean the teeth. I'm not sure whether it was toothpaste, but they used to have a little brass bowl with a liquid in, which was whitish. And I think there must have been a nice taste in it somehow. They must have put something in, because the horse used to try and lick the stuff off his teeth. But they would clean the teeth very, very carefully all the way around. And the horses used to take it like soldiers. And all of this word would be going on, "Asti, asti, asti, steady now, steady. Asti, asti, there, you know." The Rough Rider used to lift up the lip like the flap of a trilby hat and look all round, like as to see it was all done right. So, shabash, shabash, he'd say. That's shabash. Very good, very good, right? Then the part of the hooves. Once again, they used to burnish the actual horseshoe with emery paper. They used to burnish it on it really. I used to think this is silly, because as a boy, I think, well, that's going to be on the ground. You can't see underneath. You know what I mean? But apparently, this showed at the gallop. So there was all these sergeants watching for shiny hooves. They'd say, "Right now, then, gallop!" And they'd go into a gallop and then keep their eyes, see if the things are burnished. That was why they did it underneath. Anyhow, they'd go very carefully around. They manicured the horses' hooves. They had these mollish cloth. The word mollish was an Indian adaptation of the word polish. It's a mollish car, mollish. They used to put a sort of a yellowy sort of a wax in a tin. I don't know what it was. They used to rub it round the outside of the hoof. They used to get a file sometimes and file up bits and pieces of the hoof. And then they'd put the hoof on their knee, and polish it like you'd pull it, like you'd polish a pair of black boots. But I suppose the whole process took about an hour and a half to get this horse. And they were already clean, don't forget. You know, they're already clean. But they shone like the sun. There was a big Army and Navy store catalogue used to arrive annually at our house, and it used to arrive 3 months before Christmas, which was just the right time and enough time for you to rush through it and order things, because it was all shipping those days, 6 weeks each way. And I used to mark with the red pencil all the toy soldiers I wanted, like this, you know, and somehow or other my father sussed this out. I wasn't really aiming to get them. I just marked them because I liked them. And there on Christmas morning was this parcel from Army and Navy stores, with this band of the Royal Marines in a red box with all their blue and white helmets on, and a box of the Cameron Highlanders charging, and what's the other one? Arabs! Arab horsemen at the gallop, as it was, and that was in the Army and Navy stores. England was a land of milk and honey, which one day I would go back to. A land which used to send us Cadbury's military chocolates in a sealed tin once every 4 months. And they were very hard. They had to have a special quality of them so they didn't melt. And I thought chocolates were all hard. I'm telling you, England, there's that. And England was a land that sent us the Daily Mirror in that Gambo's, the Overseas Daily Mirror in that Gambo's cover once every 6 months. England was the land that sent me Tiger Tim comics, which my grandma used to take me to the cantonment on her pension day to draw at the post office. England was a land where, what was it? You could get chocolate and cream together for a penny. That's right, that's what my mother told me. It never happened like that. When I came to England, it was a gloomy, dull, grey land. India was possibly the greatest experience of my life. I grew up in bright sunshine. I liked bright things. I grew up with tremendous space. I grew up with animals. I grew up with excitement. I grew up believing that these people, the white people, were superior, most superior to anybody else. I speak for myself in this case. I was much happier then than I am now. Of course, morally, I'm glad that the empire was dissolved. But nothing better really took its place. Since then, that's all gone. And my relationships now with Indians are very, very close and very, very affectionate, and I love them very much. And I realize that the effect they had upon me was that they had a better sense of humor than the English, and that I was brought up with an Anglo-Irish Indian sense of humor, because they laughed so much more, even in their poverty, than anybody else I know. They were laughing all the time. And I would laugh at them laughing, and I developed a high degree of laughter. I laugh at practically anything, the whole human race, but I think it originated with these very kind, beautiful, gentle people who had a tremendous sense of humour, a great feeling for family life, a thing that I missed when I came back to England. I suffered withdrawal symptoms ever since.
In the fifth of More Plain Tales from the Raj, the speaker was Spike Milligan. The presenter was Evan Charlton, and the programme was produced by Michael Mason.